the same as those he had said to Bernard about the arch community songster of Canterbury.
Hani, sons, eso, cena!
And, seizing the reporter by the shoulder, he spun him round. The young man revealed himself invitingly well-covered. Aimed, and with all the force and accuracy of a champion foot-and-mouth baller, delivered a most prodigious kick. 8 minutes later, a new edition of the Hourly Radio was on sale in the streets of London.
"Hourly radio reporter has coccyx kicked by mystery savage," ran the headlines on the front page. "Sensation in Surrey."
"Sensation even in London,"
thought the reporter when, on his return, he read the words. And a very painful sensation, what was more. He sat down gingerly to his luncheon. Undeterred by that cautionary bruise on their colleague's coccyx, four other reporters, representing the New York Times, the Frankfurt Four-Dimensional Continuum, the Fordian Science Monitor, and the Delta Mirror, called that afternoon at the lighthouse and met with receptions of progressively increasing violence. From a safe distance, and still rubbing his buttocks,
"Benighted fool!" shouted the man from the Fordian Science Monitor. "Why didn't you take some soma?"
"Get away!"
The savage shook his fist. The other retreated a few steps, then turned round again.
"Evil's an unreality if you take a couple of grams."
"Kokakwa iatokai!"
The tone was menacingly derisive.
"Pain's a delusion!"
"Oh, is it?"
said the savage, and picking up a thick hazel switch, strode forward. The man from the Fordian Science Monitor made a dash for his helicopter. After that, the savage was left for a time in peace. A few helicopters came and hovered inquisitively round the tower. He shot an arrow into the importunately nearest of them. There was a shrill yell, and the machine went rocketing up into the air with all the acceleration that its supercharger could give it. The others, in future, kept their distance respectfully. Ignoring their tiresome humming, he likened himself in his imagination to one of the suitors of the Maiden of Matsaki, unmoved and persistent among the winged vermin. The savage dug at what was to be his garden. After a time, the vermin evidently became bored and flew away. For hours at a stretch, the sky above his head was empty and, but for the larks, silent. The weather was breathlessly hot. There was thunder in the air. He had dug all morning and was resting, stretched out along the floor. And suddenly, the thought of Lenina was a real presence, naked and tangible, saying, "Sweet," and "Put your arms round me," in shoes and socks, perfumed. Impudent strumpet! But oh, her arms round his neck, the lifting of her breasts, her mouth. Eternity was in our lips and eyes. Lenina! No! He sprang to his feet, and, half-naked as he was, ran out of the house. At the edge of a heath stood a clump of hoary juniper bushes. He flung himself against them. He embraced not the smooth body of his desires, but an armful of green spikes. Sharp, with a thousand points, they pricked him. He tried to think of poor Linda, breathless and dumb with her clutching hands and the unutterable terror in her eyes. Poor Linda, whom he had sworn to remember. But it was still the presence of Lenina that haunted him, Lenina whom he had promised to forget. Even through the stab and sting of the juniper needles, his wincing flesh was aware of her, unescapably real. "Sweet, sweet, and if you wanted me too, why didn't you?" The whip was hanging on a nail by the door, ready to hand against the arrival of reporters. In a frenzy, the savage ran back to the house, seized it, whirled it. The knotted cords bit into his flesh. "Strumpet! Strumpet!" he shouted at every blow, as though it were Lenina, and how frantically, without knowing it, he wished it were. White, warm, scented, infamous Lenina that he was flogging thus. "Strumpet!"
And then, in a voice of despair, "Oh, Linda, forgive me! Forgive me, God! I'm bad! I'm wicked! I'm... No, no, you strumpet! You strumpet!"
From his carefully constructed hide in the wood, 300 meters away, Darwin Bonaparte, the Feely Corporation's most expert big-game photographer, had watched the whole proceedings. Patience and skill had been rewarded. He had spent 3 days sitting inside the bole of an artificial oak tree, 3 nights crawling on his belly through the heather, hiding microphones in gorse bushes, burying wires in the soft gray sand. 72 hours of profound discomfort. But now the great moment had come. The greatest, Darwin Bonaparte had time to reflect as he moved among his instruments, the greatest since his taking of the famous, all-howling, stereoscopic Feely of the gorilla's wedding. "Splendid," he said to himself, as the savage started his astonishing performance. "Splendid." He kept his telescopic cameras carefully aimed, glued to their moving objective, clapped on a higher power to get a close-up of the frantic and distorted face. Admirable. Switched over for half a minute to slow motion. An exquisitely comical effect, he promised himself. Listened in, meanwhile, to the blows, the groans, the wild and raving words that were being recorded on the soundtrack at the edge of the film. Tried the effect of a little amplification. Yes, that was decidedly better. Was delighted to hear, in a momentary lull, the shrill singing of a lark. Wished the savage would turn round, so that he could get a good close-up of the blood on his back. And almost instantly, what astonishing luck! The accommodating fellow did turn round, and he was able to take a perfect close-up. "Well, that was grand," he said to himself when it was all over. "Really grand." He mopped his face. When they had put in the Feely effects at the studio, it would be a wonderful film. Almost as good, thought Darwin Bonaparte, as the sperm whale's love life. And that, by Ford, was saying a good deal. 12 days later, The Savage of Surrey had been released and could be seen, heard, and felt in every first-class Feely palace in Western Europe. The effect of Darwin Bonaparte's film was immediate and enormous. On the afternoon which followed the evening of its release, John's rustic solitude was suddenly broken by the arrival overhead of a great swarm of helicopters. He was digging in his garden, digging too in his own mind, laboriously turning up the substance of his thought, death. And he drove in his spade once, and again, and yet again. "And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death." A convincing thunder rumbled through the words. He lifted another spadeful of earth. Why had Linda died? Why had she been allowed to become gradually less than human, and at last... He shuddered. A good kissing carrion. He planted his foot on his spade and stamped it fiercely into the tough ground. "As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport." Thunder again. Words that proclaim themselves true, truer somehow than truth itself. And yet that same Gloucester had called them ever-gentle gods. "Besides, thy best of rest is sleep, and that thou oft provok'st, yet grossly fear'st thy death, which is no more, no more than sleep. Sleep, perchance to dream." His spade struck against a stone. He stooped to pick it up. For in that sleep of death, what dream? A humming overhead had become a roar, and suddenly he was in shadow. There was something between the sun and him. He looked up, startled, from his digging, from his thoughts. Looked up in a dazzled bewilderment, his mind still wandering in that other world of truer than truth, still focused on the immensities of death and deity, looked up and saw close above him the swarm of hovering machines. Like locusts they came, hung, poised, descended all around him on the heather, and from out of the bellies of these giant grasshoppers stepped men in white viscous flannels, women, for the weather was hot, in acetate shantung pajamas or velveteen shorts and sleeveless half-unzippered singlets, one couple from each. In a few moments there were dozens of them, standing in a wide circle round the lighthouse, staring, laughing, clicking their cameras, throwing, as to an ape, peanuts, packets of sex hormone chewing gum, panglandular petit beurre. And every moment, for across the hogsback the stream of traffic now flowed unceasingly, their numbers increased. As in a nightmare, the dozens became scores, the scores hundreds. The savage had retreated towards cover, and now, in the posture of an animal at bay, stood with his back to the wall of the lighthouse, staring from face to face in speechless horror, like a man out of his senses. From this stupor he was aroused to a more immediate sense of reality by the impact on his cheek of a well-aimed packet of chewing gum. A shock of startling pain, and he was brought awake, awake, and fiercely angry. "Go away!" he shouted. The ape had spoken. There was a burst of laughter and hand-clapping. "Good old savage! Hurrah! Hurrah!" And through the babble he heard cries of, "Whip! Whip! The whip!" Acting on the word's suggestion, he seized the bunch of knotted cords from its nail behind the door and shook it at his tormentors. There was a yell of ironical applause. Menacingly, he advanced towards them. A woman cried out in fear. The line wavered at its most immediately threatened point, then stiffened again, stood firm. The consciousness of being in overwhelming force had given these sightseers a courage which the savage had not expected of them. Taken aback, he halted and looked round. "Why don't you leave me alone?" There was an almost plaintive note in his anger. "Have a few magnesium-salted almonds," said the man, who, if the savage were to advance, would be the first to be attacked. He held out a packet. "They're really very good, you know," he added, with a rather nervous smile of propitiation. "And the magnesium salts will help to keep you young." The savage ignored the offer. "What do you want with me?" he asked, turning from one grinning face to another. "What do you want with me?" "The whip," answered 100 voices confusedly. "Do the whipping stunt! Let's see the whipping stunt!" Then, in unison, and on a slow, heavy rhythm, "We want the whip!" shouted a group at the end of the line. "We want the whip!" Others at once took up the cry, and the phrase was repeated, parrot-fashion, again and again, with an ever-growing volume of sound, until by the 7th or 8th reiteration, no other word was being spoken. "We want the whip!" They were all crying together, and, intoxicated by the noise, the unanimity, the sense of rhythmical atonement, they might, it seemed, have gone on for hours, almost indefinitely. But at about the 25th repetition, the proceedings were startlingly interrupted. Yet another helicopter had arrived from across the hogsback, hung poised above the crowd, then dropped within a few yards of where the savage was standing, in the open space between the line of sightseers and the lighthouse. The roar of the air screws momentarily drowned the shouting. Then, as the machine touched the ground and the engines were turned off, "We want the whip! We want the whip!" broke out again in the same loud, insistent monotone. The door of the helicopter opened, and out stepped first a fair and ruddy-faced young man, then, in green velveteen shorts, white shirt and jockey cap, a young woman. At the sight of the young woman, the savage started, recoiled, turned pale. The young woman stood, smiling at him, an uncertain, imploring, almost abject smile. The seconds passed. Her lips moved. She was saying something, but the sound of her voice was covered by the loud, reiterated refrain of the sightseers.
We want the whip! We want the whip!
The young woman pressed both hands to her left side, and on that peach-bright, dull, beautiful face of hers appeared a strangely incongruous expression of yearning distress. Her blue eyes seemed to grow larger, brighter, and suddenly two tears rolled down her cheeks. Inaudibly, she spoke again. Then, with a quick, impassioned gesture, stretched out her arms towards the savage, stepped forward.
We want the whip! We want...
And all of a sudden, they had what they wanted.
Strumpet!
The savage had rushed at her like a madman.
Fit you!
Like a madman, he was slashing at her with his whip of small cords. Terrified, she had turned to flee, had tripped and fallen in the heather.
Henry! Henry!
She shouted, but her ruddy-faced companion had bolted out of harm's way behind the helicopter. With a whoop of delighted excitement, the line broke. There was a convergent stampede towards that magnetic center of attraction. Pain was a fascinating horror.
Fry! Lechery! Fry!
Frenzied, the savage slashed again. Hungrily, they gathered round, pushing and scrambling like swine about the trough.
Oh, the flesh!
The savage ground his teeth. This time, it was on his shoulders that the whip descended.
Kill it! Kill it!
Drawn by the fascination of the horror of pain, and, from within, impelled by that habit of cooperation, that desire for unanimity and atonement, which their conditioning had so ineradicably implanted in them, they began to mime the frenzy of his gestures, striking at one another as the savage struck at his own rebellious flesh, or at that plump incarnation of turpitude writhing in the heather at his feet.
Kill it! Kill it! Kill it!
The savage went on shouting. Then suddenly somebody started singing,
Orgy! Porgy!
And in a moment they had all caught up the refrain and, singing, had begun to dance.
Orgy, porgy, round and round and round,
beating one another in 6/8 time.
Orgy, porgy.
It was after midnight when the last of the helicopters took its flight. Stupefied by soma, and exhausted by a long-drawn frenzy of sensuality, the savage lay sleeping in the heather. The sun was already high when he awoke. He lay for a moment, blinking in owlish incomprehension at the light, then suddenly remembered everything.
Oh, my God! My God!
He covered his eyes with his hand. That evening, the swarm of helicopters that came buzzing across the Hogsback was a dark cloud 10 kilometers long. The description of last night's orgy of atonement had been in all the papers.
Savage!
Called the first arrivals as they alighted from their machine.
Mr. Savage!
There was no answer. The door of the lighthouse was ajar. They pushed it open and walked into a shuttered twilight. Through an archway on the further side of the room, they could see the bottom of the staircase that led up to the higher floors. Just under the crown of the arch dangled a pair of feet.
Mr. Savage!
Slowly, very slowly, like two unhurried compass needles, the feet turned towards the right. North, northeast, east, southeast, south, southwest. Then paused, and after a few seconds, turned as unhurriedly back towards the left. South, southwest, south, southeast, east.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America.